Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbite. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips and the PC. It is Saturday, the 12th day of February, Anno Domini 2022, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues.
Go ahead and start without me.
Here comes... The news.
I have cable problems.
He's falling apart.
Look at him. I'm going to read the news, but you can also give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Operations at two Japanese factories producing flash memory chips have been disrupted by the contamination of industrial materials, chipmaker Kyosha said Thursday, as analysts warned of potential price hikes for these key smartphone components. It comes as the tech industry grapples with a global semiconductor shortage that has hampered the manufacturing of numerous products from cars to gaming consoles. Kyosha said it suspected contamination of materials used in the manufacturing processes, leading to operations at the plants being partially suspended, but offered no further details. The company, a spinoff of Japanese conglomerate Toshiba, said it was working to restore full output at the factories in central and northern Japan as soon as possible. Kyosha's U.S.-based partner, Western Digital, also confirmed the disruption and estimated it would cause a reduction of flash availability of at least 6.5 exabytes at the plants which the two companies run as a joint venture. An exabyte is a unit of digital data equal to 1 billion, with a B, gigabytes. The type of memory chips affected are called NAND flash chips. They are different from the semiconductors currently in short supply worldwide, which use older technology. Two factories being impacted implies that a supplier shipped bad chemicals. Other NAND flash makers are likely to purchase materials from the same supplier, so this could be a much bigger issue than we think. Kyosha, together with Western Digital, holds a 35% market share of the global flash memory industry. The consequences of this latest incident may push the price of NAND flash in Q2 to spike 5 to 10%. Before the incident, TrendForce had forecast that the NAND flash market would see a slight oversupply for the entire year, and average price from Q1 to Q2 would face downward pressure. A pandemic-fueled surge in demand for home electronics that use semiconductors has throttled chip supplies, a crisis deepened by a cold snap in the United States, a drought in Taiwan, and a fire at Japanese manufacturer Renesas last year. A number of firms have recently announced plans for new semiconductor plants as the chip squeeze continues. In November, Samsung said it would build a microchip factory in Texas in a U.S. $17 billion investment. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is contaminated flash chips may mean smartphone price rise. So far, we have 27 votes. The choices are, well, crud, guess I'd better buy now, I'm already overpaying for my phone, meh, and of course, other. So far, well, crud is ahead by one to meh. I guess I'd better buy now is at zero. Two of you have said other. If you did say other, you can head on over to our forum, again, at soundbites.org. Scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff. You'll see the forum. Second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least the number one item under poll discussion is 12 Feb 22. Contaminated flash chips may mean smartphone price rise.
Isn't it kind of convenient?
Yeah, my first thought was industrial espionage. Someone trying to short their stock.
You know, to find some reason, like everybody else, to raise the price, all they got to do is sit there and say, it's contaminated.
Yep.
How are we going to know otherwise?
It's not just smartphones. It's computers. Most computers now come with SSD drives,
right,
which use the same NAND devices, NAND chips. They sell, a million smartphones a day?
Right.
Or a million computers a quarter.
Right. Smartphones prices are going to go up. Chromebook prices are going to go up. Mac prices are going to go up.
Yep.
Pretty much everything, like you said, uses NAND chips these days. And
yeah, it was like the flood in Thailand a few years ago that killed spinning hard drives.
Right.
So it's like the farther up the mountain they were, that component was still available, but all the factories in the valley were flooded out, and it was years before hard drive prices dropped again.
Right. Well, and like I said in the news item, there's been the cold snap in the U.S. means that it's been hard to move stuff around with the snow and everything else. There was a drought in Taiwan, which meant that, water, you don't think of it this way, but there's a lot of water used in processing
keeping it cool.
Right.
Because
keeping it cool and washing the parts and et cetera, et cetera. And there was a fire at a Japanese manufacturer. And now on top of this, the contamination, we're definitely going to see some fallout from that.
Yep.
Yep, definitely.
All right, let's head to the phones. Our first caller is Jim from Irondequoit, New York. Hi, Jim, what's up?
Well, this might not be the right place to ask this question, but I wonder if you can give us a little capsule on what NFTs are and what does this blockchain business mean.
How much time do we have? All right, let me see if I can do this quickly. Let's start with the blockchain.
It is older.
It is older.
Yeah.
The blockchain is basically a series of files out on the internet. Pretty much anybody can add to the blockchain. And what it has is a series of entries that are, I won't say impossible, but very difficult to fake or change. And so it is considered a secure log.
A ledger of transactions most of the time. So it's like your company's books, but it's every company everywhere in the world.
That's exactly right.
Is in this one book.
So that's the blockchain. It's literally just a series of chained files out on the internet.
Can I consider that just software? Is that if I wanted a short name or another name for blockchain, could I call that software?
It's not software. Software is what you use to add to the blockchain, but the blockchain itself is literally just a series of files.
And the
just like you can save a document and it's a file, these are all a series of ledger entries that are all linked together in such a way that it's hard to spoof or change or fake one.
And the Bitcoin blockchain is currently 325 gigabytes.
Yeah, they're huge.
For every, because it's recording every transaction ever made with Bitcoins.
Right.
With the assumption is you can go back and verify that the same Bitcoin wasn't used to buy something different again.
Right. So that's the blockchain. It's just a series of blocks out on the internet, a chained bunch of files.
Okay.
That's that. Now, NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And fungibility is the ability to sell it and buy it and change it and move it and do stuff with it. And these are non-fungible. You can't do that stuff.
Pretty much everything we've ever bought before has been fungible.
That's exactly right.
We just didn't know the name for it.
Exactly. So when you – but here's the thing about NFTs that people don't understand. When I buy an NFT, what I have purchased is an entry in the blockchain that says I own that NFT and then links to the NFT, which is on somebody else's computer.
Usually the person that created that thing you're buying. So artists are a common use for NFTs now.
Right. So here's a simple way to look at it. you've bought. So if you have that NFT, it means you can go to that site anytime and say, this is my thing, and you can prove it by going to the blockchain and seeing that I own it. However, let's say that I have created in MS Paint a picture of a dead pirate. I was going to say
Dread Pirate.
I was going to say Dread Pirate, and I said dead pirate. Okay. Okay, it's a dead pirate.
Well, all the pirates are pretty much dead. Well, no, yeah. There's some new ones now.
So I've created the Dead Pirate NFT chain, and yep. And so I'm selling pictures of dead pirates. Steve buys one for $100. So what do I have?
You have the $100.
I have $100. What do you have?
A dead pirate.
No.
The license to look at the picture of the dead pirate.
That's exactly what you have. You have the license to look at the picture. You have the right to prove to anybody you own that link to a picture of a dead pirate. Now,
oh, so he doesn't actually own.
He doesn't own the picture. I still own the picture. It's on my server.
So you're only selling copies.
No, I'm selling a link
to view
that he owns to view it.
It's like now, the Mona Lisa. There's only one Mona Lisa,
right?
And only one person can own it.
Actually, there's like five of them, but that's a different story.
But half of them have "This is a fake" written on it in the back.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, what episode was that?
A long time ago. Listen, here's the thing. If I then... sits on my hard drive.
Right, but now I'm hoping that thing gets popular, and I can sell it to Dave for $300.
Right.
And I've made money.
Right. And now Dave owns a link to a picture on my website. But here's a question. What happens if I remove that picture or change it to something else?
Yeah, where did my value go?
Well, where did your value go? More importantly, can you sue me?
Yeah.
And I say no, because what I sold him, to make an analogy, is I did not sell him a treasure. I sold him a treasure map.
Ah.
That's what an NFT actually is.
Yeah.
It's a map to the treasure. If somebody else moves that treasure...
And you're not bound by any agreement to keep that link to...
No.
Once you've sold it to keep that out there...
Right.
I would think the lawyers would jump on that one, because
the lawyers will jump on it, but I didn't sell him anything except the treasure map. I never said this map really goes to this treasure.
Mm-hmm. You never said how long it would exist.
It will exist forever.
Mm-hmm.
I simply sold him a link.
No terms of agreement.
I sold him a map. Did Dave go and dig up that treasure before Steve could get to it? Not my problem.
Yep.
I didn't sell him a treasure. I sold him a treasure map. Is there no treasure? Not my problem.
And this is all legitimate NFTs.
Right, this is assuming they're legit NFTs. Yeah.
There's a kid in England, a 12-year-old kid, has made £300,000 selling little pictures of whale NFTs.
Right.
And so those are the stories you hear about, someone making a fortune selling NFTs, that because they hope the value goes up. The problem has become recently, just like real products get counterfeited, there are counterfeit NFTs. And people are getting scammed out of millions of dollars things that they thought they were buying. There was one in Britain. Someone bought a Banksy NFT. Banksy's a huge street artist for $300,000. Turned out it was fake.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing that happens in the art world all the time. That's why you have appraisers come along and make sure. But then you got to pay them.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a website called the NFT Bay at thenftbay.org. And it's essentially Google for NFTs.
Mm-hmm.
So you can search for any NFT and look at it. And oh, by the way, because it's the web, it would be easy enough to download that NFT. Now you've got a copy of it. Is it the NFT? No, but it's the picture of the NFT. You've got the treasure, not the treasure map.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Steve still owns the treasure map of the dead pirate, but you've got the picture of the dead pirate, which is worth more.
Yeah.
But I don't understand why, since since you can do that, why there's any value to that NFT. I mean, if I can print a copy of it out on my computer, where does the value come from? It seems like it's just make-believe.
It is.
It is make-believe. It's
pretty much like anything else. Yeah. The value is in whatever someone will pay for it. So if I pay $100, we have set the value at $100. Now, I'm hoping I can convince Dave that the value is $300. So then he'll pay $300 for it, and I make some money. But right. then he's got to convince someone that the value is even higher so he can sell it.
Right.
Pyramid scheme.
Kind of, yeah.
It sounds like this is something that's bound to fail.
Well, it is possible that it will become real and in some odd way. Look, what makes anything worth money? People agree that it's worth money.
Right. So why is the Mona Lisa worth, you know, $50 million?
People agree that it's worth $50 million.
Yeah.
So it is possible that NFTs will, in fact, become a real thing at some point.
If they can find. So, yeah, so they're going to have NFT authenticators, just like they have art appraisers, to make sure this is real before someone actually buys it.
Right. But you can go, you yourself, if you have the right tools, can go look through the blockchain, the NFT blockchain, and find that Steve does, in fact, own the link to the dead pirate.
Yeah.
And he can do that and say, look, I own this.
Yeah. What we're seeing a lot at the beginning is it's sports celebrities, you know, movie celebrities are creating NFTs of their brand. So you can get a Nike swoosh as an NFT, and no one else can own that Nike swoosh. So Nike makes 100 different swooshes and sells them to 100 different people.
That's exactly right. And there's the Bored Ape Yacht Club and Crypto Puppies and Farmers World. There's all kinds of NFT.
Ooh, I was off. Mona Lisa is valued at $870
million. $870
million.
Assuming that the real one
is hanging in the Louvre. Yeah.
Probably not.
But at any rate, that you're absolutely right. That's what NFTs are. They are what Steve bought from me is an entry in the blockchain that proves he owns a link to a file that I could move at any time or change. What if instead of the dead pirate, I suddenly put up a picture of Yoda?
Mm-hmm.
In that spot, and the link goes to the picture of Yoda now. Nobody knows. I mean, there's going to be lawyers making billions off of these things.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I created that picture of a dead pirate. I can reproduce that picture,
mm-hmm. put it somewhere
ad infinitum, and sell one to Steve and one to Dave and one to Al.
Yeah.
You know, and say, well, you know, this I sold one to Steve for how much did I say?
$100.
Yeah. I can now go to Dave and say, you know, this originally sold for $100. I'll give it to you for only $150 because it's appreciated in value. And Dave goes, holy crow, $150. That's cheap. Here you go.
Yep.
And I can make money. Look, as with, I don't want to call it a Ponzi scheme. Because
P.T. Barnum said
I don't know why I don't want to call it. I'm not sure why I don't want to call it. Well, at any rate, the point is...
The people who create it are going to make the most money.
Right.
Well, it's the same kind of thing in cryptocurrency now. The people who started it are making the most money because it's very difficult to make Bitcoin now. You have to buy someone else's Bitcoin and hope the price goes up.
Right. It's Ponzi scheme,
stock market,
the people who got in first make the money.
Yeah.
But this is not really a Ponzi scheme because there's no secondary market unless, like you said, Steve can convince Dave to give him $150 for what he paid $100 for.
Pyramid scheme somewhat.
It's like buying, you're a collector.
You collect a bottle of wine.
Right. You never drink it.
Never drink it. You hope the price goes up so you can sell it for more money. Or you can say that with prestige, I own this bottle of wine.
That's the point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically a collector's mentality.
Yeah.
So Steve can now, Steve now has bragging rights that he owns the dead pirate. He doesn't. He owns the link to the dead, but it doesn't matter. Steve owns the dead pirate, and he has those bragging rights forever. And if he's a collector, he can go and say, I own Dead Pirate 1, Dead Pirate 2, Dead Pirate 3, and it only costs me $1,000 because I love making brand new Dead Pirates.
Yep.
But that's how, that's basically NFTs are treasure maps. That's what they are. And that's all they are.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yep. And I know it's not an easy explanation, but that, there is no easy explanation.
Yeah.
Particularly when you ask why. I'm sorry. Why ain't cutting it?
But
yeah.
Too broad.
Yeah. Okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot, gentlemen.
Yep. Thanks. Have fun.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Yep.
And that was the 1979 episode of Doctor Who titled City of Death.
Where
he convinces Da Vinci to paint, the master convinced Da Vinci to paint 5 identical Mona Lisas.
Right.
So in the future, he can steal it from the Louvre and sell it 5 times to underground collectors.
Right.
Because an underground collector is not going to tell anyone they have it.
Mm-mm.
And so what happens near the end of the movie that Da Vinci has a big, should I spoil it? It's been 50 years.
It's been 50 years.
Yeah.
There's a big fire in Da Vinci's studio, and so the doctor takes a Sharpie and writes "this is a fake" on 4 of them. And they're not sure which one survived the fire. So if anyone x-rays the Mona Lisa, they'll find "this is a fake" written on the back of some of them.
Yep, exactly. But yeah, the whole idea behind an NFT is that it is for collectors. It is a collector's mentality. Yeah. And there are many, 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 many people who only want to collect. They don't want to sell forward. They don't want to, you know, they want to own it. And and that is a perfectly legitimate reason, by the way.
Collectors.
To buy an NFT. I'm not disparaging the people who buy NFTs. You just have to go in with your eyes open and know why you're buying it. If you're buying it for bragging rights, you win. Absolutely, you win. So, yeah.
I kind of liking it a little to the stock market. You put money in the stock market, you won't mind losing.
That's exactly
right.
You
may make money out of it, but you probably won't.
Right, right. So, in general, like I said, I'm not disparaging people who buy NFTs. I feel bad for people who buy them for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
But I'm not disparaging them. Right, right. If you're buying it as a collector, it is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. As long as you understand what you've bought.
Knowing the risk that you're going into.
Right. So if, for example, you buy an NFT for somebody and they die, at some point their website is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And now your link goes nowhere. So the thing you bought, bought, has disappeared.
Yeah, it's gone.
You still own the link. You still own the treasure map. There's just no more treasure. I sell you a treasure map, and you end up going to the island, and you find out it's gone underwater.
Yeah.
Well, okay, you still own the map.
Oak Island. My wife watches this show every week to find out if they're going to find the treasure.
And every week they don't.
Right. Because that would be the end of the series.
This is the most exciting find in 200 years. It's a piece of dirt. Okay, good for you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 29 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Nudging users toward security works. That's the top line finding 4 months into Google's initiative to enroll users in two-factor authentication by default. Last October, Google announced plans to turn on two-factor authentication by default for 150 million Google users who are not currently using it, and to require 2 million YouTube creators to use it. In the latest post, Google said it observed a 50% decrease in accounts being compromised among that test user group.
Yep.
The strategy shows the power of a tech giant like Google to provide security by default and fits into a years-long project to move users toward a more robust security model, eventually aiming at a future without passwords, according to another blog post published by the company last year. Two-factor authentication, or two-step verification as Google terms it, is a core pillar of this strategy, since account security is significantly increased by the requirement for a physical item like a security key or phone to receive codes via an app or SMS. But historically, the problem has been one of adoption. Google has been on a path to make two-step verification a default option for a greater share of users and a mandatory step for some. One of the barriers is a lack of understanding about the full benefits of additional authentication procedures. There is a lot of educating that needs to happen with two-step verification. Google also needs to make sure that users' accounts are set up correctly with a recovery email and phone number so they can avoid account lockouts once two-step verification is enforced. Although the number of web services supporting two-factor verification has grown steadily, consumer adoption still remains low. Twitter, which rolled out two-factor authentication in 2013, revealed in 2020 that only 2.3% of active accounts had enabled it. At Facebook, the figure was around 4% adoption in 2021. Where adoption exists, most common two-factor authentication option is to send one-time codes via SMS, which security experts consider the method most vulnerable to interception. Ideally, two-factor authentication should make use of an authentication app like Google App Authenticator or Authy, or a physical device like a hardware security key. Do you use two-factor authentication? Why or why not? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, people always talk about how much of a pain it is to use it. And they say, well, that's kind of the point.
Yep.
That the bad guys have that much trouble, too. They're not going to be able to break into your account. Right. And that usually turns into, I don't have anything worth stealing.
Well, it's especially critical for banking, and I would think.
Yeah, anywhere that has money, especially.
Right. I have two-factor authentication set up for almost all of my stuff, and the few that don't have two-factor authentication, I'm getting out of. Because if they don't care about security, I do.
Yeah.
It's a momentary inconvenience.
When you set up your account on a new device.
Right.
So it's not that often that you have
Even then, every time you log in, you have to type in a number. Oh, how terrible is that? I have to type in a number. Get away from me.
Well, until something happens, and then all of a sudden, they've got to go
through
that.
How could that possibly happen?
They got to go through the hassle of, verifying that, they didn't do this transaction or that transaction. They've got all this money tied up, and,
And their credit cards have to be changed, When all they had to do was type in a little number.
Yeah, usually a six-digit number.
It's not that big a deal.
And what gets interesting is when you are on your own computer. So we see this a lot setting up new computers for people. They're on their own computer. They're logging into their account. The code comes to their computer that they're on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And okay. But the point is, if someone else is using their computer and tries to log into your account, you're going to see that code. They're not, because they don't have your computer. So they can't get into your account because they're not getting your code.
Right. Or if it goes to your phone, or it goes to, so it goes to your phone, and then you have two devices, two things, and that's two-factor authentication. Yep. The first factor is your username and password, something you know, and the second factor is your phone, something you have. Now, it's better with something like Google Authenticator or Authy or one of those, but better SMS than nothing is how I feel about it. So,
and for an SMS attack, it would be, you'd have to be really targeted for someone to
Right.
Get your SMS and clone your SIM card. So you'd have to be like a high-ranking government official.
Right. For for the average person,
to put the effort
SMS
into.
Yeah. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. Hi, James, what's up?
Oh, hello. Yes, I have two laptops, a Dell that is using Chrome, and I also bought inexpensive Acer, like a $200 one to have as a spare. The problem is, all of a sudden, I have a pop-up box showing up in the lower right corner that says, McAfee, pop-up, you are at risk. And I looked it up, and I think it's a scam. It pops up a couple of times a day.
Did you say one of these is a Chromebook?
No. This is an Acer laptop, a cheap one.
It's possible that McAfee came pre-installed as a trial and has expired, but it's more likely a fake notice is trying to trick you into paying for something that you don't have.
Yeah, have you gone into your programs to see about uninstalling it? Is it listed there?
I don't think I have it.
Listen, the thing is, many cheap laptops nowadays, the reason they're inexpensive is because they've made deals with other companies who pay them to put their software on your machine. So it is possible you have a trial version of McAfee.
And it would be listed there under installed programs.
Right. So if it's there, you can uninstall it.
Okay.
Now, you should have some form of antivirus running on your machine, but it doesn't have to
know. This has Edge.
No, that's not an antivirus
program. Browser.
That's a browser.
No, what normally comes with an inexpensive Acer laptop? Would you happen to know?
Is it Windows? What version of Windows are you running?
10.
Then you have the ability to run the Windows antivirus program, Windows Defender.
Defender, yeah.
If you are running both Windows Defender and McAfee, then you don't need both. So the first thing to do is to check to see if Defender is running.
Mm-hmm.
If it is not, you can turn it on.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, then you can check to see if you have McAfee installed, and if you do, uninstall it.
Yeah, should I use Revo to uninstall it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what if it's a scam that's popping up because I think somebody had gone on a bad website? I don't know.
Then you have to do the Security Tango and remove whatever malicious program got installed.
Malware.
Tango.
Yeah.
Okay, the whole Tango, or is there a specific...
Well, it would be best to run the whole thing, particularly if you don't know who's been going where on your machine.
Yeah, that would be what, a virus? No.
It could be a virus. It could be
malware, spyware.
Some other sort, spyware. It could be anything.
Okay, let me try all of that. Thank you for your information. I appreciate it.
Yep. Good luck.
Okay.
And it just struck me. It may be, thank you. It may be, did I get it?
Yeah.
It may be just the Microsoft ads coming up.
That's true.
Because Windows will show you all sorts of ads, and maybe it's just an ad for McAfee.
Well, like you said, it was probably since he got it cheap.
Yeah.
All those other bloatware items are thrown on it.
Yeah. That's the problem with inexpensive. I love inexpensive laptops because the first thing I do is put Linux on them, and I know that they're clean and they're whatever I put on them. Wipe them out
and start over.
But for the average person, when you buy an inexpensive laptop, I won't say cheap. Many of them are indeed cheap.
Yeah.
In terms of quality of build, but I'm talking inexpensive here. The reason that you get to save money is that the manufacturer made their money by letting other companies pay them to put software on your machine.
Yep.
So you often, as Dave said, that's called bloatware. It's stuff that bloats what's on your machine. Usually inexpensive laptops come with smaller hard drives, which means that more of your space is taken up with somebody else's programs.
Yep.
You find that on inexpensive phones as well. Only on an inexpensive phone, you can't uninstall them.
Yeah.
You're stuck with those things. I've seen 8 gig cheap phones that only had 1 gig free.
Because they've got all that bloatware that has
been can't be removed.
Yeah, it's been burnt into the EEPROMs.
Right.
That just can't sit there like you can on a computer and say, yeah, uninstall this one, uninstall that one. No, it's burnt into the phone and it's part of it.
Yep.
Many times when you first buy the machine, it's sneaky. I just read. You can go into the recovery program and reinstall Windows. Erase the computer and reinstall Windows.
The very first thing you do.
Very first thing you do. And it won't reinstall all those extra programs.
Right.
You'll just get a clean Windows.
So anybody who's recently bought an inexpensive laptop and found it full of bloatware, you haven't done much to it yourself, make sure you've got a good backup of all your data, of course. But then you can just reinstall Windows and get rid of all that bloatware. But, that's one of the issues with an inexpensive laptop. And beyond...
And even some of the expensive ones, which is really annoying.
That's really annoying. And that's, you know, Macs generally don't have that problem.
Right.
I don't think they have that problem
at all.
They
come with all the Apple apps, but it's a photo editor and a video editor and a music editor, things you right. may use.
Well, and if you don't want them, you can uninstall them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're buying that to do nothing but programming,
yep.
you can get rid of all of those, and it's easy. But,
yeah.
you know, and it's easy to do. And if you buy a Linux machine, it comes with nothing but what you need, so... or you put Linux on it. So
actually, with Linux, it comes with nothing but the OS.
That's pretty much.
You have to install every app manually.
Right. Well, nowadays they do have the desktop version.
Yeah, comes with
so you
Office
get
products.
LibreOffice
yeah.
and that stuff and the GIMP and blah blah blah. So there's a bunch of stuff that you can get with it. But if you want it, you can get the absolute lowest end, bare bones, nothing machine, and do what you want with it. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, so those of you who have purchased inexpensive laptops might want to look around and see what's in. So you usually get a bunch of games. No, you usually get a bunch of game demos.
Yes.
Which are less than useless.
Yeah.
Because once you've seen how good they are, you either want to buy them or you're never going to look at them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So why have you got them on your machine?
Yep, they're taking up space.
Right.
And again, using Revo Uninstaller.
That should be the first thing you install on a new machine.
To get rid of all that junk. Because just simply using the Windows Uninstaller, that's about as handy as a screen door in a submarine.
Yeah.
Doesn't do much of anything other than turn one bit off, and then it still leaves all that mess in your registry. And makes the machine slow down.
That's why we've seen registries as large as 2 gigabytes.
Oh, yeah.
And then people wonder why it takes forever to start up their Windows machine.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're loading and then going through 2 gigabytes worth of stuff before you can use your machine.
Or they're installing stuff and they don't take the time to slow down. And it'll say, well, we're also going to install this. And, oh, we're also going to install this. Because a lot of programs come with additional mm-hmm. tag-ons.
It's yet
like
another
call.
Way that they lower the price to you by getting money from other companies.
And here's the secret, folks. While you're installing the main part of the program, like I say, they've got these other tag-alongs, you can say, as it's slowly going through and installing, it'll say, hey, we're also going to install this. You can decline. There's a button there that you can sit there and decline. It's not going to stop the install of the main program. You're just declining to install that additional add-on. And you can do that for each of them.
And often it's internet toolbars. And you can get so many, you get so many toolbars loaded, you can't see the web page you're looking
at. Oh, yeah.
And
really? Yeah, I saw, back a while ago, this person had to have, they had 10 to 12 toolbars. I said, do you use all these? I don't know. They just keep showing up when I install stuff. Because you're telling them to. No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, you are. And I had to go through and get it down to, I think we wound up with 2.
Right.
Because I wanted the one besides the normal one. And it's like, whoa, look it. You can see the rest of the screen.
Pretty amazing.
The scene from the IT Crowd where he tries, the Jen asks him to install a browser. And there's so much pop-ups and ads. And I haven't seen that one since the 90s.
Yeah.
No, wait, don't touch it. I've got it just the way I like it. You like 27 messages blinking in your eye?
Yeah, right. There's, yeah. And those many pop-ups, like we've said, are just from sites you go to on the internet. And most of the time,
you don't even have to click on an ad. They've gotten so bad now that just viewing the ad can install the malicious program.
Yeah, hover. Right. Just hover.
Yeah.
Right. So, and not even necessarily that anymore.
Yeah, true.
One of the biggest things you can do to help protect yourself is don't run as an admin. Make another user with standard privileges, and a lot of that stuff can't install itself without asking for your permission. Right. And if you didn't know you were installing an app, say no.
Say no. It's that easy.
Yeah.
But you know what? One of the issues Microsoft has always had with Windows is that when you buy a Windows machine, the first user is the admin.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody ever makes a second user.
No, they don't have time for it.
Right. So when you first start up a machine, create a user. Don't call that person admin, by the way. Make up a name and set that person as the admin, and then use that person to create your account. Now, what that means is when you want to install a program, you have that extra step. You have an extra step where you have to acknowledge that you really want to do this.
Yeah, same thing on a Mac. It's the first user created is the admin.
Right. But what that means is when you do get one of those downloads, some will still happen because browser add-ons are added to your browser. So that's going to happen anyway. But any time that you have a serious infestation, it needs admin privileges to install. And if you are not running as admin, you cannot get those problems.
Right.
That is one of the things that makes Linux so secure. When you install Linux, you are not the administrator. You have administrator privileges, and what that means is every time you want to install something, it says, prove you're the admin, give me your password.
Yep.
So if the password prompt pops up, and I wasn't trying to install something, I cancel, and the thing cannot install. And that is one of the things that makes Linux so much safer than either Windows or the Mac. And that's ironic because Macs run on the same basic Unix-derived
kernel.
You're
the admin, but you're not the root.
Right. I can be an admin, but I'm not root. Right. Exactly right.
But still, as an admin, it can install. Malicious software can get installed in your home folder without permission.
Right.
To get installed in the system, it needs permission.
Right.
So we'll oftentimes, and people, there's some malware that keeps installing Chromium. So an old version of it's an old version of Chromium that apparently still is unsecure. So then they can install the other things.
Right.
Because we keep seeing Chromium running, and people have no idea what it was and how it got there.
Yep.
But yeah, if you're the admin, things can be installed without you knowing it and without asking you.
So don't run as admin on a daily basis. And you don't need to. If when you buy that new machine, you make the first user some other name. Don't use admin. Use, I don't care, captain. Admiral. I don't
captain,
care.
Captain, my captain.
Oh, captain, my captain. Admiral. Call him Kirk. I don't care what you do. Don't call him admin. Don't use your name. Then, as Kirk, create a new user with your name and then log in to your user. And then you can use the machine and do anything you want, but in order to install software, you then have to prove you're you, and other stuff can't automatically install most of the bad stuff. It's the way to do it.
Yep. And that's where a lot of the bugs that get fixed. If you read the description, it always says maliciously crafted X can lead to privilege execution.
Right.
So now the bad thing is the admin and can install something remotely.
Right. Right. So for example, under Linux, it is almost impossible to install something in the system itself through my user. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's almost impossible. And that makes, that makes Linux very much more secure. Whereas on Windows, if you are the administrator and you go to a malicious website, it's going to say, hey, I want to install this. Oh, okay, you're the administrator. Of course you can install this. Audio, and it installs it.
Yeah, it just does it.
Yeah, so...
Or, you know, or worse, something asks for your password and you give it to because it asked. Well, if you don't know you're installing software, then don't give it your password.
Right. If you're just wandering around somewhere and it asks for a password, yeah, don't give it.
We hear that a lot. Why does it keep asking for my password? Okay, one, you asked it to install a program. It needs your password.
Right.
Or two, you didn't know you were installing something, so don't type your password.
Right. Well, and that is just now, again, I keep using Windows, but that is also awesome. True yep. of the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to be aware that you are not any more secure on a Mac for this thing. You are no more secure on a Mac than you are on Windows.
And these are the bigger threats these days.
Right.
We joke that the virus threat has really fallen off.
Yeah.
And the big threat now is malicious software and fake ads and fake tech support and ransomware that comes from websites that ask you to install things.
Because they found yeah. a way of now making money
yep.
off of stealing information from your machine. I mean, the viruses didn't gain them squat. Yep. So what? It erased some right. files. No big deal. Right. They didn't make any money out of it. Whereas they now turned around and got a little smarter and developed programs that run in the background and steal things like, say, just your all your email addresses.
Right.
It can grab all your email addresses and then sell them to other vendors and make money on it.
So let's say I get a penny a piece for email addresses. Well, I've only got 300 email addresses. That's just $3. Yeah, that's you. But Dave has some, and Steve has some, and I've got some. And by the time I'm done shooting out my malware, I've collected 100 million email addresses. And you do the math as to how much that's worth.
A billion email addresses is common on spam
right,
lists now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So...
I like how the spammers will break into each other and steal spam
lists.
Yeah.
Steal the spam list. One hit and you've got a billion names. Yeah. So that makes sense. But, yeah, so be aware that not running as admin is the first defense. You can create a user, even right now, you can create a user, make them the admin, and have them take away admin privileges from you.
Yeah. So if you have been using your computer a while, you can make a new admin, log into that account, and then remove admin privileges from the account.
So when you log back in as you, you still have all your software, all your data. Everything is the same. You just can't install software easily.
Yeah.
So that means nobody else can.
Right. In the early days, some programs wouldn't run without being in admin.
Right.
But that's pretty much long gone now. Yeah.
And don't think that just because we said viruses aren't a big deal anymore that you should stop running antivirus software, because nothing dies on the internet. There's still 100 billion viruses out there trying to break into your machine. So anyway, we're going to take our first hour seems to be done already. Holy moly. Well, don't get excited. We've got a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. That's right. It's Soundbites with a whole nother hour of Dave Enright, a whole nother hour of Steve Ray, way too much Nick Francesco, and all of you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You are listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on the truly great. And truly grateful to you that we continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you on the other side.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, you are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbites. Right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. I have to tell you, during the five-minute break, I upgraded my computer.
Took you that long?
Yeah, no, not all of it. But I upgraded my computer. I got back all my tabs. I restarted my Linux container. So I did a lot. I got a lot done in that 5 minutes. And for those of you who are wondering how that happens, it's a Chromebook. So it actually updates in the background. And
does it usually? Mine does it overnight.
This one wasn't on overnight.
Yeah, so. It just says, oh, wait a minute, got to restart.
And that's all I did.
That was a story we had a couple weeks ago. You need to leave your computer on at least 8 hours for an update to load.
That's right. Well, if you're on Windows, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here it was far less than an hour. It said very quickly into our first hour restart for your update. So yeah, I do love my Chromebook. Fast, easy, simple. And depending on what it is you do, it's really everything you need.
Well, that's why I still laugh when you sit there and say how, you know, worrying about being an administrator and everything else and all this stuff. I'll still never forget the day we're sitting here at the show and here you're running your Chromebook and you got a warning that your Windows machine was infected.
The whole window turned red. The whole screen was red. It was a giant thing.
Yeah, it was like, look. Yeah, and it's like,
your Windows machine is infected. Click here. No, I think no would be the correct answer.
We used to be able to say, you know, don't go to the seedy parts of the internet, and you'll be fine. But now
the seedy parts are coming to you.
Yeah, well, yeah, I was going to say they're here already.
You almost have to credit the first bad guy that realized he could buy an ad on a mainstream website.
Yep, yep.
And now that's how the bad stuff gets in, is ads on websites.
Yep.
So,
and it's a problem. I mean, I run ads on a couple of my websites. And I really hope, particularly at the Security Tango, I really hope that they're not bad ads, but I have no control over that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you buy an ad, now I tend to run mostly Google ads, and Google is pretty good.
Yeah. Nothing's going to be 100%.
Nothing,
there.
But Google is pretty good. So, but it is an issue that kind of everybody has. And it's something you got to learn to deal with.
Some people try to run an ad blocker. Right. But a lot of websites just don't work with an ad blocker because that's how the website makes its money. If there's no ads, the website goes away.
Right. You run an ad blocker, and when you go to the site, it says, oh, you're running an ad blocker. Please unblock it to see this website.
It was an ad blocker.
Right. All right. You can give us a call, by the way, while I read this next news item, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Apple has acknowledged an iOS 15 bug that may have recorded interactions with Siri on some devices, regardless of whether the user opted out. The bug automatically enabled the improved Siri and dictation setting that gives Apple permission to record, store, and review your conversations with Siri. Apple says that it identified the bug shortly after the release of iOS 15, stopped reviewing any recordings inadvertently received, and is deleting info received from affected devices. After discovering the bug, Apple turned off the feature for many users, that's Apple's own word, and corrected the opt-in setting when it released iOS 15.2. This is the reason why you might get a prompt asking for your permission to enable the improved Siri and dictation feature once you install the new 15.4 beta, or eventually its official release. This seems like a serious enough bug that Apple should explicitly warn users and urge them to ensure their iPhones are up to date while notifying anyone affected. As it is, Apple's statement still leaves unknown how many phones were affected or when. Without transparency, there's no way to tell who may have had their conversations recorded and listened to by Apple employees, despite asking to avoid exactly that outcome. If you have an iPhone, now might be a good time to update to iOS 15.2 or later if you haven't already. For users who haven't yet upgraded to iOS 15.2 or higher, Apple confirmed it has stopped reviewing recordings and continues to delete any data received. So, do you know who's listening? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, it's a lot of industry analysts have said the one reason that Google's voice assistant does so good and Siri isn't is that Google listens more.
Yeah.
Google knows more about you because of the Google ads and Google searching. But Apple keeps pushing the security options on the iPhone. And it's embarrassing when something happens that shows that isn't quite as true as we'd hoped.
Yeah, exactly. If you are an iPhone user and you don't want Apple listening in, you should check. I don't know where you check. Where do you check?
That's a good question. Let me find it. I know.
Thank you very much.
when you set up your phone or computer for the first time, it will ask if you want to allow Siri to save recordings.
Right.
So my guess is it's in the Siri preference.
I suspect that would be true. Now.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can do...
Of course it's a Mac, though.
Right. Well, right. One of the things that you should be aware of, whatever your personal platform preference is, pickled pig's feet, is that all of these devices... Listen, that's why you can use the trigger phrase, the Alaska phrase, or the echo phrase. I suppose I shouldn't have said that. Or the hey and the G word.
Key trigger words.
Right. Mm-hmm. They respond immediately because they are always listening. All these devices do that, but they do not. Those trigger words are built into the product itself and don't leave the product. So only after you give the trigger phrase does it then pay attention to what you're saying and send that up to the servers to be analyzed.
Yeah.
And that's true of all of them. That's been tested by experts time and time again.
Some of the phones try to do on-device recognition, right, but often they can't. And most of the time, the thing you're asking needs an internet search anyway.
Right. But generally speaking, when you are talking regularly day to day, those words never leave the device. It is only when you say... when you give the trigger word that they then record that information and say that it's going somewhere. So be aware that you have to manually say, go ahead and use my stuff to improve your system. And on the Mac, apparently there was a bug that meant that you had agreed whether you agreed or not. Check your settings to make sure that you are not sending data out. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Brad. Where are you calling from, Brad?
Brockport.
How are things in Brockport?
A little snow. It ain't no big deal.
Oh, good. What's up?
I got a tablet, Android tablet, and I hear you talking the last few weeks about the Chromebook. And I thought about getting a Chromebook, but all I wanted to do was, bet on the mobile sports betting. And I haven't put I got Casper Sky on my PC.
You have what?
I haven't put it on there yet.
Kaspersky.
I got Casper Sky.
Yeah.
Kaspersky, whatever the hell.
Whatever,
you call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just wondered, I know you guys really talk, the Chromebooks are really good, so... I'm just wondering if I should bite the bullet and take this tablet back and get a Chromebook.
Well, it depends on what you're using it for. If you're happy with the tablet, keep it. There's no reason not to have it.
There may be more apps available for Chrome, especially because the new Chromebooks can run Chrome apps and Android apps.
Yeah, and right. If you don't
and
like
Linux,
if you don't like tapping on the screen for typing, you know, if you're typing right. anything of that, a Chromebook would be nice because then you have a regular keyboard.
But it depends right. on what you yeah. use it for. And an Android tablet, certainly a tablet, is more portable and easier to carry around, and et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
You know, for example, I have both a Chromebook and a tablet. I almost exclusively use my tablet as a e-book reader, as an e-book reader.
Okay, that's kind of what I was thinking of.
Yeah, but it also means that I've got it with me if I'm sitting in front of a television, like downstairs, and I want to look something up on IMDb. I've got that tablet right in front of me.
Right.
I personally don't find it as convenient as using a keyboard. But it works. So I don't necessarily, depending on your
usage.
Financial abilities, I don't see this as an either or situation.
Well, I could get either one. It's not a financial thing. It's just a matter of what would be better as far as, and I got that Casper Sky on the PC.
Right.
And I was wondering if that's a good antivirus or.
Kaspersky is good. It is good. As long as you're keeping it up to date and as long as you're continuing to pay and et cetera, then yes.
Yeah, I run it like every 4 or 5 days. I run an update and yep. scan it and everything.
Perfect.
Okay.
You know, if you've already got a desktop and you're not looking to get a laptop, you don't really need a Chromebook.
Okay.
So, you know, a desktop and an Android tablet will give you the same capabilities that you're looking
flexibility.
For.
Flexibility.
And flexibility.
So just apply the Casper Sky on the tablet, and then I should be good.
Yeah, they have a version, so do half a dozen other companies have an Android version. So, yes.
Okay. All right, that's what I wanted to know.
There you go.
Thank you. I enjoy your show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have fun.
All right, thanks.
Yep. You should. It doesn't matter what your device is. You should have some sort of protection on it.
Yeah. And a lot of times you can have your tablet be a second monitor for your computer.
Right.
Which is kind of handy because I'll often have them sitting next to each other just like I do now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like we said, I personally prefer to do most of my work on a large screen. I'm old. I'm fine, but my eyes are old. And so...
No, it's your arms aren't long enough. That way you're not admitting you're getting old. Right. Your arms just aren't long
just
enough.
Just aren't long enough. So I prefer to do most of my stuff on a large screen, which either the desktop or the Chromebook satisfies. I also prefer to type on a keyboard because I'm a touch typist.
Yeah, doing it on a...
Right.
But
the convenience of carrying around a tablet, particularly using it as an e-reader and for the occasional let's look this thing up sort of stuff.
And surfing the web, just looking for different, you know, articles and that type of stuff and reading them, like you say, news and all that other stuff. It's great.
And speaking of voice stuff, you can search with Google using your voice. If you've ever paid attention, when you bring up the Google screen, there's that box where you type stuff in. But on the far right of that box, there's a picture of a microphone. And if you tap on that or click on it with a mouse, you can now speak your query. And so I use that more on my phone than I use typing to do.
Often when I'm driving, too.
Exactly. When you're driving, you can have your phone, you can talk to your phone and have it do all kinds of things for you. But even on your tablet or your desktop or your Chromebook or anything, you can use voice searching to do an amazing number of things. In fact, on a Chromebook, there's a dictation button right on the toolbar across the bottom, and you can then use
just
that.
Speak away, and there you go.
Right, into anything. And if you are using Google's...
how far that has come.
Drive, yeah, the Google Docs, then you can turn on voice dictation in that. And it works like real dictation. So you would say, you know, blah, 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 comma, blah, 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 period, new paragraph, blah, 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 blah. And it puts it all right in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's
kind of freaky.
Continues to astonish me. And I'm, you know, I'm often a fast talker. And it keeps up with me. It lags behind me a little bit, but it never loses anything. You do have to be, you either have to have a headset or you have to have decent diction. You know, if you're mumbling, if you're slurring, mm-hmm. you know, it's not going to catch stuff. But in general.
And a decent mic.
You want to have a decent mic if you're going to do this. But it does work, and it works pretty well. I have actually recorded, Bab, you remember those days when we all met in groups around a table and could see each other's faces? Remember those days? I used to record meetings that way. Stick my Chromebook in the middle of the table and hit dictation and let it just... And of course, I'd have to go back and edit it because, yeah. you know, people don't say new paragraph or whatever, whatever. But
you could, one giant sentence.
Yeah, pretty much the way it worked. But you could record a meeting that way.
Yeah. Some of the recording apps now are smart enough to tell different people talking.
Yes.
And can separate it out that way.
Yes. So it's there's a lot of capabilities in these machines, and that capability exists in, for example, Google Drive, Google Docs, say. So it works exactly the same on your desktop, your laptop, your Chromebook, your phone, your tablet. Because it's all really happening at the web. Now, if you have a very low-powered tablet or phone, for example, it may lag a little bit behind. But any decently powered machine will handle that without a problem. And there are just amazing capabilities nowadays. One, you know, I do a lot of writing, and I have increasingly more severe arthritis. So there are times when days like yesterday, holy moly, I hurt every joint. Mm-hmm. was stiffened up. But I had a bunch of stuff that I had to get out. I had to write it and get it out, and I dictated it all.
I love the sounds that deadlines make when they go whooshing by.
Yeah. Way over my head where I can hardly see them. Yeah. But yeah, so I did a bunch of writing using dictation, and it worked great. I had to go in and take out some ums and you know, that sort of fare, but it saved my hands significantly, and I still got all the work done. It means I can't be, you know, I can't have the TV on in the background or
well, it's a little less stress than that too. Right. You know, I mean, you can just sit there calmly, you know, and dictate, and it's doing it for you. And, oh, shoot, I misspelled it. No, it will figure out the spelling and everything else for you. So, yeah. And like you say, the key thing is you also have to tell it, though, for punctuation.
Right. That's all you have to do. Yeah. We aren't yet at the original Battlestar Galactica thing where he would just talk and it would put in the commas and the periods.
Yeah, no.
Oh, before we forget, normally, Sunday nights at 9 p.m., we have the Soundbites Lounge, courtesy of Mastermind Lounge. We will not have that this week because it is the Super Bowl. And
51st.
Am I allowed to say Super Bowl? Well, I've said it now.
Yeah. Well, it's on. I mean, it's no secret. Yeah.
Well, the apparently the league has threatened other radio stations from using trademarks without paying for the trademark.
Right. So the Super Bowl will be happening this tomorrow.
We're just telling folks to go watch it.
Yes.
So we're driving business to them.
Yeah. Still their trademark. They can decide what they want to do with it.
That's exactly right. So there will be a sporting event tomorrow night, yeah. And we will not be having the Soundbites Lounge. That's the important part of this.
I'm going to go with the tiger is going to kill the sheep.
You think?
not many sheep are going to beat out over a tiger.
That's true. But we'll see what, you know, whoever makes the most baskets or whatever it is they do.
Who has the prettiest uniform?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you'll be. And, of course, there's a. The only time I've really cared about the halftime show was when a friend of mine was a choreographer. Because I knew she would call me up the next day and want a critique.
Yeah.
Not a critique. She wanted me to tell her how amazing it was. And it was. It was quite amazing. But, yeah, I don't. Generally. I watch the Super Bowl for the ads.
Yeah.
Football, not my game.
And quite often you can go on YouTube and find all the ads before.
Well, exactly beforehand. Right.
And longer versions of the ads. You know,
right.
Some of these ads are like a 2 or 3 minute mini movie that they spend $100 million on.
Right.
And then they can only show 60 seconds on the Super Bowl.
Well, it costs hundreds of.
Yeah, let's see what the commercial price is this year. $7 million a 30.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is David from Irondequoit, New York. Hi, David. What's up?
Hi, Nick. I just wanted to remark on your very good suggestion about the administrator thing there. About when I got my new computer from MicroWorks about 6 years ago, you happened to mention that same thing, and it served me very well to have that separate administrator name on there.
Yep.
And so, you know, just to it's good that you kind of remind people every once in a while.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate that. Yeah, it is becoming increasingly more important that you do not surf the web as the admin because it saves you from so much grief.
Right. And this is leads to the other thing that I wanted to mention. Our food cupboard computer email was hit with spam where it tried to get us to call a number to renew our Norton subscription for like several hundred dollars.
Yeah.
And they're using a well-known name, so they think they can get away with it.
Right.
Right. And all I had to do is look into where it was sent from that, you know, to see that, this isn't right.
Yep. Exactly right.
So that was a lazy spammer. There are some better spammers that can hide where it's actually coming from.
Well, that's the warning that people should take away as well. But, you know, I go to a local store and get Norton for 10 devices for like, you know, $40.
That's the other thing that's a shame is people don't realize they're getting ripped off, even if that was a legitimate program. They don't know what the real value is.
Right.
Right.
No, yeah, excellent points.
So I've never renewed any subscriptions
through those things. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to let your listeners know that it can hit even a nonprofit computer.
Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. They don't care. They just want your money.
And these what's unfortunate is these scams have been around forever and have moved digital. It used to be the toner scam where a company would send an invoice to a business and it would just get paid.
Right.
And it's a fake company selling fake products and they steal the money.
Yep.
And now they went digital, so they can send. It's a lot easier and cheaper to send a million emails than it is to send paper invoices.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Cheap, right. Yeah.
All right, David. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Have fun. Yeah. Be aware of these things. We're going to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. Hey, listen, vote in the poll, will you? Soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1. It's a short break, so we'll be right back.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Get down, get funky, get up, take a shower. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm David Ray.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 33 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. We are, of course, live on the air. We're on the stream. We're on YouTube. We're on Twitch. We're on Facebook. We're on it's hard to avoid. It's out. We're on our app.
Terrestrial radio.
We're on terrestrial radio. it's hard to avoid us. And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like what?
I was going to say the star, Jalice 3325, is just now receiving our first show.
Nice.
It's 33 light years away.
33 light years away. Our next caller is Bill from Irondequoit, New York. Hiya, Bill. What's up?
So we have a few Apple devices, a couple phones, and an iPad. My wife has an account, and I have an account. My wife, unfortunately, has two accounts. So her iCloud is in one Apple account, and her phone and everything else is on the other Apple account. I'm sorry. So what do I do to consolidate it all?
The easiest way is to make an iCloud family, and that will let you share your purchases between your Apple IDs. A lot of times the intent was that you could share your stuff between mom, dad, and the kids. But where so many people have accidentally made a second account that you can share it with yourself because you have two accounts.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Easy enough.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Have fun. That was simple.
We constantly hear people who they go into a store and they buy a new phone and they're setting it up and the clerk makes them create a new Apple ID. No!
Why?
I don't know.
Because they were in shoes. Shoes last week.
Yeah.
Somebody gave them a checklist, and one of the items on the checklist is create an account.
Right. Not ask if you already have one and use it.
Right.
Or the other thing that happens is you forget your password. So instead of using the password recovery, you just make a new account.
Right.
Without realizing that everything you bought under that other account is still locked to that password. So any music you bought, you can't listen to anymore. Applications you used, you can't update anymore. So don't make two accounts. It's confusing.
Right. But if you do, you can family...
You can family share them, so then you can share your information between yourself and yourself.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, that's good. Good. That used to be illegal in many states. Anyway. Yeah.
Me, myself, and then you got to get the third one in there.
Exactly. Yeah. All right.
It also lets you share subscriptions. So one person can, say, subscribe to Apple TV, and the other person can watch shows on their devices with their ID.
So as in my case, I get a text message that says, Dad, would you buy this movie?
That's called a daughter.
Yeah exactly. Yeah.
Well, see, that's why I said mom, dad, and the kids. Yeah.
Right. Right.
They leave home, but they don't ever go.
Oh, yeah. Ain't that the truth? All right. For the second time in as many months, Cupertino released iOS, iPadOS, and macOS updates to address a critical WebKit security defect that exposes Apple devices to remote code execution attacks. Again. Processing maliciously crafted web content may lead to arbitrary code execution. Apple is aware of a report that this issue may have been actively exploited, Apple said in a rather bare-bones advisory.
If you look up the CVE number, there's a lot more information.
Yeah. The WebKit flaw fixed in iOS 15.3.1, iPadOS 15.3.1, and macOS Monterey 12.2.1 is a use after free memory corruption issue. That's the big one and has been for years. That was reported by an anonymous researcher. Apple said the WebKit code was cleaned up with improved memory management. This is the second actively exploited zero-day fixed by Apple in the first 2 months of 2022. Late last month, Apple used the same language in the disclosure of zero-day exploits, hitting a memory corruption issue in an off-targeted iOS kernel extension. Earlier this week, malware hunters at Microsoft called attention to a nasty macOS malware family that has evolved quickly from a basic information-gathering Trojan to a stealthy backdoor with much more powerful capabilities. So, is your Mac up to date? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. You know, the days are long gone when you can say, well, I don't get viruses, I have a Mac. I'm not vulnerable to any of this stuff.
I'm pedantic. I don't get viruses, I have a Mac.
Yeah.
There's tons of other malware besides viruses.
That's right.
They're susceptible to all computers.
Well, that's, matter of fact, like you were saying, though, the viruses that are out there, like you said, though, they're still out there. Once you put something out on the web, it never goes away.
That's
It's living somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a computer in a closet somewhere still seeding code red to the internet.
That's exactly right. So you do need an antivirus program.
So you still need those. The big thing, you know, like we've said before, you don't ignore viruses, but you got to focus a little more attention on the spyware and malware,
right?
Because that's their new focus now. That's sort of gone off to the side as far as viruses. It's still there, but stealing your information is where they're making money. And I know we sound like a broken record, but that's the truth.
Yep. And what's happening is that there's sort of a tension in the industry between the good guy hackers and the bad guy hackers, where if a researcher finds a vulnerability, they can give it to the company and collect a bounty, a few hundred thousand dollars maybe, or they can sell it to a bad guy group for millions of dollars.
Yes.
And depending on how bad a vulnerability it is.
Yeah.
So it's tough. And you can actually make a good living now being a bug bounty hunter if you're good at it, collecting bounties from legitimate bug bounty programs without needing to stoop to selling to the bad guys.
That's exactly right. And there are people who make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Well, it's just like these thieves, though. I mean, they're making hundreds and thousands of dollars. And you've heard it, folks. People call into they've called in the show where they didn't realize that they were being conned.
Right.
And they called that number. They clicked on that web page and they went to it. And then they told them, oh, yeah, well, we got to get into your machine. And they had to pay them so much money. And now they're out the money.
And now that this vulnerability has been announced, the bad guys know it and will start exploiting it more. It's interesting. So this was a zero-day exploit, meaning that it was already being exploited by the bad guys before the good guys found it.
Right.
And so that's a big thing. When the bad guys get a vulnerability, they don't want it to be found so they can use it longer and get more money from it. So it's really interesting. So Pwn to Own this year is going to be in Miami, April 19th through the 21st. So that's one of the big hacking contests where groups will show off their skills in what they have found. And one of the rules is that you have to tell the publisher how you did it.
Right.
So that they can fix the problem.
Right. But you make a decent amount of money, and really it's bragging rights for these guys at this point. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Joe from Rochester, New York. What's up, Joe?
Hey, guys. I wanted to ask a question. How difficult is it to write an extension for like Thunderbird? And the reason why I ask because I use an older version of Thunderbird because the extensions were much more robust for the older versions, and now it seems kind of limited.
The companies are adding more security to prevent bad things from happening, so that does kind of make extensions a little harder to write.
Oh, right.
And a lot of times it was just a guy that wrote something he wanted, and now he doesn't need that anymore, and there's no one keeping it up to date.
Right.
And that's what I was thinking. Write stuff you want, and then just make them for myself.
They aren't difficult to write if you're a programmer.
Okay.
They're not difficult to write if you're a programmer. That's really the best thing I can say. If you know what you're doing, writing an extension is a fairly simple thing. In terms of the connecting it to Thunderbird and all of that part,
getting the hooks
that's,
in there.
That's basically a done deal. There are frameworks out on the web. You just download them and you're done. Then writing the actual thing itself inside that framework, that's hard.
Okay. That's the hard part, right? You said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know a little bit of HTML, but that won't help, probably, right?
Probably not, no.
Okay. JavaScript and CSS are also widely used. One of the things that's available is that there are several different freelancer networks where you can hire a programmer to do a specific job, and you can decide how much you want to pay for it and put it out and see if anyone will accept that job.
I'm not that desperate.
Yeah, there's a place called Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R, where you can hire people to do stuff. Originally, it was $5 to do something. Now, of course, it's whatever the market will bear.
There's freelancer.com is another one.
But if you're curious, you can go to developer.thunderbird.net and see what it takes to be a Thunderbird programmer.
Okay, cool. Awesome. All right, guys. Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right. Yep. Have fun.
Thanks. Bye.
Yep. And then, you know, once you write your extension, as Steve said, extensions for Thunderbird work a lot like most Linux programs. Somebody had an itch. They scratched it. They made that scratch available to everybody. And the same thing is true of many things like Thunderbird extensions. But yeah, you can't easily write an extension anymore. Part of it is the security. Part of it is that you need to know languages other than just HTML to do it. But yeah, it's all doable. It's just obviously it is. People are doing it every day. And you may already have an app or an extension rather that does what you want to do. You just have to find it in the many millions of apps that are out in the marketplace in the Thunderbird extensions list. So it's just a matter of doing some research. And that just takes time and effort. But you can go to the Thunderbird extensions and do searches.
And oftentimes there's forums on the extensions you use, and you know, post a question: anyone want to update this extension, or any plans to update this extension for a newer Thunderbird, or you know, whatever feature I'm looking to add.
Right, and it is quite likely that although the app you've been using doesn't work on the new version of Thunderbird, there's another one that does and does the same thing better. So, you know, don't automatically give up just because when you update an app stops working. Find a replacement for that app. And often it's as easy as going to Google and say, what replaced X, right? Whatever your app
is. Alternative 2.
And go to alternative2.net and look up alternatives for things. It's actually pretty easy. I'd say that... in general, there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of extensions for Thunderbird, and the likelihood that the thing you need to do has already been done is very, very high. It's just a matter of finding it. But again, because there are hundreds of thousands of extensions, it's very hard to find the one you specifically want right now. Dave's got a look on his face.
So
he's got a collect call.
A collect call. We don't do collect calls.
Yeah.
Someone in jail.
We have an 800 number. Why do it?
Someone in jail has a very urgent computer question.
That must be it.
They want to sell us a warranty for our car.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I got one of those calls the other day. I was just in one of those moods. So I picked up. I said, we're here to talk to you about your car's extended warranty. He said, I got a car? Hold on.
Honey, we got a car.
We got a car. Where is it? Where's my car? And then I got on the phone. Where's my car? Where's my car? It's not in my driveway. Where is my car?
Usually they don't let me have cars in prison.
Well, I had him call, though, it was a couple weeks ago, about my extended warranty.
Yeah.
On a car that I owned previous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like,
that's a really extended warranty. That is.
That's an old mailing list somebody bought.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I love the screening feature on my phone.
Oh, I use that so much.
When a call comes in, I can hit screen.
Yep.
And it says the person who owns this phone number is using Google screening.
Yep.
Please state your name and your blah, blah, blah. And by the time they get to that point, they've hung up.
And then it marks it spam and you can sit there and block it.
Scam likely.
Yep. So I really.
It's tough in our business because we have to answer calls from unknown numbers.
Yes.
Because it might be a customer.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, you guys forget it.
For a while, I took to answering unknown numbers in Esperanto. I gave that up after a while, but I did. And then for a while, I was doing the Dorothy Parker thing where you pick up the phone and say, what fresh hell is this? But
Jay Silverheels interview with Johnny Carson. He's looking for a job.
Oh, yeah.
Tanto go to Toronto to speak Esperanto and pronto.
Yeah. Jay Silverheels, Rochester lad. Yes, yep. Indeed. I've told you the story of I met him as a kid. Man, it was great. Except nobody believed me.
No.
Pictures or it wasn't true.
That's exactly. Well, I was
they
five.
They photoshopped you in.
What, 7 years old, 8 years old, and we didn't have a. My father said, let's go. We're going to the store. I said, I don't want to go. He said, let's go. I said, I don't want to go. He said, we'll get ice cream. I said, okay, I'll go. So he got in the car and he goes to this house and he goes, knock on the door. I said, I'm not going to go knock on the door. So I go knock on the door. The door opens. It's Tonto in the buckskins and the full regalia, the knife on the belt, the whole thing. It's Tonto. He married an Italian lady. My father knew the family. He was in town with his wife to visit the parents.
Yep.
And they said, I know you got a kid. He's got to love the Lone Ranger. I mean, he's got to. He's seven years old, whatever I was, 8 years old at the time. He said, bring him over. Well, like, Tonto. I went in. I had tea. We had tea. I've never had tea in my life. It was very exotic. I had tea. He signed a bunch of autographed pictures, and it was great. The problem is nobody believed me. Not one of my friends believed I had met Tonto.
Nope.
but I knew every time I watched the Lone Ranger after that, I knew what was in that coffee pot on the campfire. It was tea.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Nobody took the time to take a picture with you?
It was 1957 or 8 or whatever it was.
George Eastman
invented the
camera before
that. We weren't all camera happy back in those days.
They were called black and white.
Listen, I have in my head the picture of that door open, the movie of that door opening. That is never going to leave me. I'll tell you that right now.
He went to East High School and played lacrosse.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah, he was a Rochester fella. So... I met Tonto. I didn't meet Jay Silverheels. I actually kind of, I was 7, 8 years old. Yeah. I didn't meet Jay. I met Tonto.
That's actually unusual for actors to do appearances in character.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He had the costume for whatever reason, with him. Well, and when your in-laws say, do this for my friend, you do this for your friend. It has nothing to do with the public.
Wasn't there a big mess with Clayton Moore trying to do appearances as the Lone Ranger and got sued and couldn't do it?
Right. Well, that was because the show was over and it was done. And this was not a public appearance. It was for a public of one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Home visit.
Yeah, it was a home visit.
That
I went to Tonto. Tonto didn't come to me.
Yep. That was one of the things that made the Galaxy Quest movie so interesting is that the actors were doing the bits in costume. So when they ended up getting sucked into the alien spaceship, they were all in costume.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The big thing is that what were we just talking about before that? Oh, Thunderbird extensions.
Yeah. Writing them.
You can, like I said, if you really have something that no one else has done, you can go to somewhere like Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R, Fiverr.com, I think it is, and hire someone to.
There's several R's in it.
Yeah. There's at least two. And you can hire someone to write your software. In fact, you can have people bid on it, which is generally better for you. And then you know, it works like any other marketplace. I'll do this, you know, I can guess that song in 15 notes. And then you pick the one you want and say, show me some of your work. Show me some of your, the people who've loved your work or hated your work or whatever it is, you know, show me your reviews, show me your, how many stars you got and all that other stuff. And so then you can pick the person to do the work for you. Now, those are for one-offs. That's generally not for, I need somebody to write and maintain my website.
Yeah.
Right? This is strictly a one-off sort of thing. But, you know, if you're looking for somebody I know people who wanted to have converters for Excel spreadsheets to something.
Yep.
Right? And yes, it's easy enough to do if it's a simple spreadsheet, but often they want this column and that column and only if it's this and only. Well, and you find somebody who writes that stuff and you pay them some money and it's done. And now it's done until you make some sort of odd change to the website, to the file. That has to then be rewritten, but you know, it's a one-off. You do the one thing, and it's going to work until you change the parameters. So it's a fairly simple, fix. So if you're looking for that one-off, and you can't coerce a friend into doing it, Fiverr is your new friend, and it works pretty well. I know a number of people who've had things done by somebody like Fiverr, and they've been very pleased.
I remember reading a story about a programmer who outsourced his own job like that.
Uh-huh.
And so they were paying him, you know, $50,000 a year. He paid someone else $20,000 a year to write all the code, and he kept getting great code reviews and getting bonuses and getting raises until they figured it out.
Yep. And they hired the other guy at $20,000, yeah. Saved the money. Yeah. But yeah, there's lots of people out there, particularly this is the gig economy. You know, people yep. get a short gig and they do that thing and that's their money. And there's plenty of that out there, and there's plenty of people who are looking to make a few bucks here, a few bucks there, particularly in this economy, particularly since they're all working from home all day anyway. So if you're looking to get something like that done, Fiverr is a good place to find that and to get it done.
There was a big mess in California a couple of years ago, 2020. Proposition 22, in essence, made gig working illegal. That if you worked for the same company, you know, like twice, they had to hire you, call you an employee, and pay you benefits.
Interesting.
And so it was designed to work with delivery driver companies. To make the delivery companies consider their drivers employees.
Unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences where journalists couldn't freelance write for the same paper every week anymore. They had to become an employee. So there were a lot of the people I read, you know, had to stop writing for certain magazines and news links, or they had to move out of California.
Right.
So the law didn't apply to them anymore.
Right.
But fortunately, last August, the state judge ruled the law was unconstitutional and unenforceable. So gig workers can still gig, but now the driver protections don't exist.
Are gone, right?
Yeah.
Right. You know, the problem with that is people write laws that are unenforceable. It just makes you look weak and kind of stupid.
Yeah, and the only companies trying to uphold the law are the ones that are trying to be legal and end up hurting the constituents they're trying to serve.
Right, right. In many cases, people do want to be full-time employees, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't for whatever reason, and those people are hurt. All right. That music tells us this show is done. But you should be aware that we are always available on YouTube and in our archives. And so you can listen anytime you like. Please, please vote in the poll. But we are done. And so for Dave Enright and for Steve Ray, I'm Nick Francesco. We'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you because it is only, solely with your support, because we are member-supported, that we can bring this show to you week after week. So thanks to each and every one of you. We'll see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?